Welcome to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Today, we pay special tribute to the life of one of the Triad's most beloved artists, pianist, educator, humanitarian, Ruskin King Cooper. He died suddenly last month at the age of 54, and we'll remember the man and consummate artist with some of those who knew him best. Then it's time to celebrate another Triad treasure, the North Carolina Black Repertory Company and their thought-provoking play, Accept, Accept, by Karima. Wendy Walker is here to walk us through. Next, his drawing struck Vincent van Gogh dumb with admiration, and 100 years later, they inspired the pirate costumes worn by Johnny Depp. 19th century illustrator Howard Pyle is the subject of Wake Forest University professor David Lubin's pre-screening talk at Rinalda House tonight, and then it's time for The Adventures of Robin Hood. And Triad artist Todd Drake is looking for social justice in his own way with his work, Help, Hidden Work, Hidden Lives. And Peter Karoff will discuss the composer who put the T in Tortured Artist, all coming up next on Triad Arts Up Close. On July 18th, the Triad lost a consummate artist and a man beloved by all who knew him well. Pianist, educator, and lifelong learner, Ruskin King Cooper passed away far too young at the age of 54. Today I'd like to celebrate Ruskin's life and incredible artistry by talking with some of his colleagues in the music world, soprano Barbara Di Maio Caprilli, who toured Italy with Ruskin, Ruskin's colleague, pianist and Davidson College Associate Professor of Music Mauro Botello, and jazz classical pianist educator Federico Pivetta, who gave Ruskin lessons in jazz piano. Ruskin Cooper lived life to its fullest, traveling the world not only as an admired piano soloist and chamber musician, but as an accomplished multilinguist in search of the perfect accent, and he remained fascinated by different cultures and people wherever he traveled. Ruskin gave generously of his time, energy, and resources to a host of causes, raising several thousands of dollars for the National Multiple Sclerosis Society in honor of his mother. He loved cycling and cooking, and he even dreamt of one day opening a soul food restaurant in Berlin. Ah, but how to get those collard greens delivered to Germany from home. First among all of those loves, though, was always music. In fact, Ruskin's love for music began even before he could speak, and by the age of 4, he was already singing several songs in perfect pitch. It wasn't long before that vocal ability eventually found its way into Ruskin's singing piano style. As a piano soloist, Ruskin thrilled audiences throughout the Southeast, Europe, and Mexico, and in 2009 he toured Italy with a program of American music. He was joined by acclaimed soprano Barbara Di Maio Caprilli.
It was a little tour set up by a friend of his who has an evening of concert series. It goes through the Macerata region in that part of Italy. We sang in churches. We sang in an outdoor venue. There were 3 places that we sang. One of the churches, they did a recording. The guy from La Scala who does the recordings at La Scala did a great recording for us, and that's the one that was on the Vatican Radio. The outdoor venue, we had a little bit of trouble getting the piano out, and the Italians were all fussed and having a hard time, and what's going to happen, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, Ruskin was just calm and cool and just the way he is. And then we did one of the concerts in this round church, which has the most amazing acoustics. And I was able to do these wonderful pianos and all of this other stuff, you know, just great stuff that you don't normally get to do because you don't have the acoustics to do it. After we got through with Give Me Jesus by Moses Hogan, who, by the way, he knew, he went to school with Moses Hogan, we went back so I could get a glass of water, and he started crying. And I said, Ruskin, what's wrong? And he said, it's just such beautiful music. So I'll never be able to sing Give Me Jesus again without thinking of Ruskin, that's for sure.
I can see how, in many ways, his own personality makes the collaborative aspect of what you do as musicians easier, working together to get the program ready and working through the rehearsals.
He's a wonderful colleague in all ways. We decided on the program together. I had already done a program with another friend at Salem College of the Gershwin, Cole Porter, and Irving Berlin music. And we talked through what we should do, and he liked this, and he thought maybe that one, we needed a fast one here and another one here. And then as we were playing, he said, look, I've been listening to the Gershwin piano rolls, and some of these songs are in there, so let's work out a way for me to use some of that music.
And by Gershwin piano rolls, we mean Gershwin actually recorded himself playing the piano. It was recorded rather than by tape, but by what they used to use, which is a piano roll, literally, that with punched holes could remember exactly which note was placed where. So it was basically Gershwin playing.
Yes, and of course these were solo pianistic arrangements, but he wanted to add some of that music to the song, so some of the songs were chosen for that reason, so that he could put in some of the piano roll music. And having been used to people that play what's on the page a lot, it was really interesting to do these early composers, Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, and Gershwin, with Ruskin, because he doesn't play what's on the page. He plays what it's supposed to sound like.
I'll build a stairway to paradise where the new step every day.
What an incredibly generous soul he was. And I haven't talked to a single person about this who hasn't mentioned how loving he was and how everyone just cherished him as a friend.
Well, I'm wondering if you could speak to Ruskin Cooper, the musician, the pianist.
Well, he was a fabulous pianist and also a great chamber musician. As you know, the two of them don't necessarily go together. And when he played the music that was dear to him, the German Romantics from the circle of Robert Schumann, and the music of the United States from, you know, the mid to the late 19th century and the early 20th century, He was incredible.
Was there an approach, a style, a sound that you would say, oh, that's Ruskin?
Well, he had a very beautiful, a nice, warm tone, which, of course, was very well adapted to the repertoire that he liked. And his music was always very polished. You could tell that he had spent all the time necessary to polish every single piece, you know, just to a fine sheen on them. He would never, not only in his music, but in everything in his life, I don't think Ruskin would do anything halfway. It was always as close to perfection as one could get.
I used to play in an orchestra in Mexico for several years, and so he was just starting to get into Spanish big time as one of his other hobbies. People may or may not know that he was a lover of foreign languages, so we used to sit and have our Spanish luncheons, and that was always a pleasure to see him working through not just the most simple tenses, but really pushing himself. So that kind of ties in with your last comment. No matter what he was doing, he really went whole hog.
Your mention of the languages is correct, because he was fluent in several languages. Working at Davidson and living in Winston-Salem meant that he spent hours on the road, and I know that he would work through tapes and CDs of languages as he was driving. So there's another aspect of the man making time to develop his skills at any single opportunity that he would have.
Mauro, what will you miss most about Ruskin?
Just running into him unexpectedly in the hallway, trading a few phrases in Italian or Spanish or whatever the language of the day would be, and enjoying his time around. He was a great cook, you know, and so whenever we would have a potluck meal or something, you could always count that Ruskin would bring some goodies to liven up the meal. And the one thing that I want to mention that many perhaps won't know is that Ruskin was very concerned with issues of social justice. And so he used his language skills to help recent immigrants. He used his love of cooking to cook for those less fortunate, church meals and that sort of thing. And that is as admirable of a quality as everything else that we've talked about, and something that I will also remember him by.
So, Federico, how did you get to know Ruskin King Cooper?
I've known him on and off. I mean, for the past, I will say, 20, 25 years, when he was at School of the Arts. I know he's, I mean, I remember obviously being a very accomplished pianist. Then later I found out, you know, knew that he taught at Davidson College. He was also a very, very avid accompanist. I think he also taught at Salem, if I'm not mistaken. Definitely a great, great, great musician. That's how I knew him. And we were also neighbors, actually. He lived on about four or five blocks, I mean, from our house in Armour. So we were, you know, lived very, very close. Sometimes I would walk in front of his house or cycle in front of his house or so forth.
You see, that's the other point of connection. With this. Okay, it's reasonable to expect a couple of pianists live within a few blocks, but then you put in that you're both pianists, you're both teaching, you're both cyclists.
I wouldn't say I'm not ready for the Tour de France or anything like that, but yeah, it was something that we actually really, truly enjoy. But I remember he will send me an invitation every year. Usually in late August, he was very active in the Tour of the Tanglewood, and he used to raise money to fight multiple sclerosis, which I believe his mother fell victim of that illness. But yeah, that was another interest that I guess we had in common. We used to talk, you know, from Steinways to music to cycling to macaroni and cheese, etc. So it kept it kind of interesting.
Your piano playing is unique, at least to my knowledge, in the Triad era in terms of the level of proficiency in both classical music and jazz. And that's something that you shared with Ruskin as well, at least his appreciation for jazz and kind of wanting to get there. And I understand that he took some lessons with
you. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Probably 3 or 4 years ago. I cannot recall exactly. Yeah, we probably had, I will say, between 8 or 10 lessons, which actually made it really fun personally. He has such a great command of the piano. I understood harmony, theory. I mean, I could say something, and of course, I mean, things will click immediately, and that makes my job, you know, a lot easier. That was kind of a very enjoyable part of working with him. And we talked about, you know, the usual things you talk about, chords, you know, voicings, how to make, you know, a lot of these great songs from the American Songbook, which actually when you have just a couple of chord changes and a melody, how to make them better, how to make them sound more interesting. I think we have lost a great friend, a gentle soul, a fantastic musician, always very humble. I never saw him. He was very soft-spoken, very quiet. Occasionally he'll throw a joke, I mean, and he'll say something and all of a sudden everybody's laughing. But just a very, very simple person who had just a great love for music and for life in general. So yeah, it's a great loss that we've had. Thank you.
That's pianist, educator, and a friend I wish I had been able to spend more time with, Ruskin King Cooper. My thanks to Winston-Salem-based jazz and classical pianist and educator Federico Pivetta, Davidson College Associate Professor of Music Mauro Botello, and soprano Barbara De Mayo Caprilli for sharing their memories of Ruskin with me today. On July 12, 2012, Ruskin collapsed suddenly and never regained consciousness. He died far too young on July 18th at the age of 54. For the past 15 years, Ruskin had been a Davidson College Artist Associate, where he was beloved by all of his students and colleagues. His critically acclaimed CD featuring American piano music is titled American Classics, and we've been sampling from it throughout the program. We just heard from Ned Roram's collection of three barcaroles, a piano song titled Tender. American Classics also includes music by Samuel Barber, George Gershwin, Louis Moreau Gottschalk, and Ruskin's personal favorite from the CD, Graceful Ghost, by William Bolcom, which we're sampling right now. The music department at Davidson College is planning a memorial concert in honor of Ruskin King Cooper to be held in the Sloan Music Center's Tyler Tallman Hall at 3 p.m. on September 30th. You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. We've got swashbuckling pirates, Knights of the Round Table, and Robin Hood will make a short cameo today as well. But first, when we get back from this short little break, we're off to the theater. North Carolina Black Repertory Company's Wendy Walker is here to talk teen theater, accept, and much more when Triad Arts Up Close continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. The North Carolina Black Repertory Company was established in 1979 by Larry Leon Hamlin. It's our state's first professional black theater company, attracting the finest actors and directors from across the country. That tradition continues today under the leadership of Executive Director Jerry Patton and Artistic Director Mabel Robinson. The North Carolina Black Repertory Company's international outreach is the National Black Theater Festival, which they produce every other year. Coming up August 3rd through the 5th at the Arts Council Theater in Winston-Salem, the Repertory Company presents the gripping and thought-provoking play Accept by Karima. Shows are at 8 o'clock with weekend matinees at 3 and a special youth campers performance August 3rd at 10 a.m. You'll find links to ticket information and more on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Audience Development and Public Relations Manager Wendy Walker stopped by to talk about it.
Accept was presented at the 2011 National Black Theater Festival, and it sold out. It is a conversation between a young man running from the police and a slave that meet at a tree. One of them is running for his freedom. You can hear dogs barking in the background. The other one is running towards an end that may have him losing his freedom. You will not want to miss it, and you really won't want to miss the discussion afterwards. We've got city council members that will be leading the discussion. We have a minister that will be leading a discussion, and people just need to be there.
Yeah. I thought it was well put by Chandra Gwynn, the director of the Mary Lou Williams Center for Black Culture at Duke University, when she wrote that about the powerful yet kind of innocent questions that are being raised by the slave in this case, really forced her to ask herself, was she indeed living the dream and hope of the slave?
That's right. And people will sit and it will really cause them to think, because we know that the slave was there hundreds of years ago. But this young man walks up to him and he knows nothing about life. And it's not just because of the years that separate them, but it's just the wisdom the slave has. things that he can tell this young man about his life. So it's very, very thought-provoking.
One of the big goals, it seems like, with North Carolina Black Repertory Company is this idea of, you know, black theater is for everyone, and expanding that reach and going into various communities. How's it going? Is it gaining any new residents over the last year or two?
We have reached out to the community, and of course there is a lot more that we want to do. But we are finding that our audience is getting a little bit more diverse, and we want it to be a lot more diverse. We share the building with Twin City Stage, and of course we support them and they support us as far as being in the same building and working around the same arts program and providing art for Winston-Salem and surrounding areas. But we would like to partner with other nonprofits and other social organizations as well as churches. We can help them with their fundraisers and also just have people work as a liaison between their organization and ours.
Have you done this in the past? Like, can you give an example of a collaboration that worked particularly well?
We worked with a sorority where they were sponsors for one of the evenings of a production that we did. And of course, you know, we have their name posted very prominently, but we would like to do more of that. We also had just recently a Marvtastic Talent event. And it was a contest of regional talent. Mm-hmm. And one of the groups was a multicultural group that actually won second place.
All right. And you got to break down Marvtastic for us, for those listeners not in the know.
Marvtastic is the word that was coined by the late Larry Leon Hamlin, the founder of the North Carolina Black Repertory Company. And it is a combination of marvelous and fantastic. So we say Marvtastic.
Yes. And Mr. Hamlin began this venture how long ago? How long has the company been around?
The company was founded in 1979 by Larry Leon Hamlin. Jerry Patton is our executive director, and Mabel Robinson is our artistic director. So we are starting our 33rd season.
Wow. And tracing that that evolution over the years, the initial focus and where it is in 2012.
They have really evolved from a small repertory company that did theater in Winston-Salem to an international company. And we are international by way of the National Black Theater Festival, which is held biennially in Winston-Salem. We have very high quality theater that we bring to Winston-Salem every other year. And also with that, we have actors, directors, producers, we have technicians, designers, anyone that's involved in producing plays comes to Winston-Salem.
I wanted to hear more about this idea of special memberships. Could you flesh that out for me?
Sure. We have what we call the Marvtastic Society, which was started in 2003. And the Marvtastic Society are members that support the National Black Theater Festival. In 1981, the company started the guild membership, and the guild members support the Black Rep throughout the year.
Okay, National Black Theater Festival, a hallmark for this city, and also, gosh, it's just a great moneymaker for the city as well. Could you, I mean, for those who've never been, I mean, I guess I really, as someone who has attended events, want to make that pitch that, boy, if you never tried this, you got to go, because just speak to the quality, for starters, of the actors involved.
You know what, David, it's just top quality performers we bring to the city. We get hundreds of submissions, and our selection committee is very careful about who they invite. They comb through those submissions and make the best selection. So we have some plays that sell out after the first night. Word gets out that the play was really an excellent performance, and you know, our phones are ringing off the hook. We've got people waiting in line to buy tickets the following day because we have such high quality. The Teen Theater Ensemble is under the umbrella of the North Carolina Black Repertory Company, and it's directed by Mabel Robinson, who is our artistic director. the teens put on about three productions per year. And Mabel Robinson hosts those auditions, and she trains the teens, and they get just a broad range of everything from acting, dancing, singing. She will bring in some guest artists to speak with the teens.
And we should point out that Mabel Robinson, I mean, they're getting trained from the best of the best. I mean, a Broadway star, and she's done it all.
That's right. Mabel Robinson is fantastic, and she is awesome. She is just a jewel in Winston-Salem, and people will see her work, or they will know her from Black Nativity that she directs every year.
And what is the production this year?
The production for teen theater is The Last Class, Five Letter Words, and that's going to be October 19th through the 21st. And auditions will be September 8th. Everyone can go to our website and find out the scheduled times to audition. Teens between 13 and 18 should give us a call to set up an appointment.
My thanks to North Carolina Black Repertory Company Audience Development and Public Relations Manager Wendy Walker. The play is Accept, Accept by Karima, starring Stephen Prescott in the role of G and Michael Alside in the role of Jonah. Inside New York correspondent Susan Sojourner Collier calls the play a two-character masterpiece, and you can see the performance at the Arts Council Theater in Winston-Salem, August 3rd through the 5th at 8, with weekend matinees at 3, and a special Youth Campers performance August 3rd at 10 a.m. You'll find links to tickets, Teen Theater Ensemble audition and performance information, and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and we're going to take a short break now. When we come back, our good friend Peter Karoff will be tickling the ivories and breaking down the emotional music of the Romantic era great pianist, composer, and music critic Robert Schumann. That's Karoff at the keyboard next. Welcome back to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and now it's time for my favorite part of the show, understanding classical music. So much to understand in so little time. So how about Schumann in 5 minutes with Karoff at the keyboard?
Today I'd like to talk with you about one of the most romantic of all of the Romantic era composers, and that is the composer Robert Schumann. Romantic in what sense? Well, in two senses. First of all, Schumann was one of those impulsive romantic composers in love with love, in love with music. He embodied the spirit of the early 19th century. He was also crazy about literature, as were so many of the Romantic era composers. And so there's a kind of literary element, that a kind of poetic element that is infused in Schumann's music that we can hear throughout. One of the other real sad aspects of Schumann's life is that he was plagued with some mental illness throughout his life. Nowadays, we might have been able to diagnose it as manic depression. Back then, he just said he had these fits of creative activity where he would just not sleep for 3 days and compose and compose and compose, and then moments of black despair. And that kind of split personality between the really, really energetic, almost manic doer, the outgoing composer, versus the kind of inward-looking and somewhat more depressive personality actually shows up a lot in his music, sometimes just side by side. I don't know if you know the beginning of the Piano Concerto that he wrote in about 1841. Very dramatic, very energetic opening, and that is immediately followed by can't help but feel those two sides of Schumann's unfortunate personality, the energetic and the outgoing, and the dreamer. Schumann himself recognized these two aspects of his own personality. He had two sort of pen names that he would sometimes use: Florestan, the energetic aspect of himself, Florestan, the energetic and the outgoing, and Eusebius, or Eusebius, as he would have pronounced it, the poetic, thoughtful dreamer. Schumann was a master of using harmony for expressive purposes. Falling figure, and then it reaches. Now just listen to that harmony for just a second. Ouch. There's a D minor chord, but with the E on top that doesn't belong in there. And it creates this moment of tension, of pain, which is instantly resolved. Sometimes I almost feel as if Schumann's music is sort of a direct translation from feeling into sound. That sense is reinforced by the fact that often Schumann uses a very flexible rhythm. For example, this well-known piece. That high note sounds like it ought to be on the downbeat, but it's actually on beat two of the measure. Those few notes create their own little rhythmic unit. There's another echo of that rhythmic unit, and then so that where the strong beat is shifts. It's very almost improvisatory, a real sense of spontaneity in this music. In Schumann's mind, feeling, literature, sound, all fused together to create this musical entity, which for him, as he said, was even more poetic than poetry itself. Robert Schumann.
Understanding Classical Music with Karoff at the Keyboard. And my thanks once again to the amazing pianist and Wake Forest University Professor of Music, Mr. Peter Karoff. This is Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford, and it's time for a trip to the Flickies. Tonight at 9 o'clock, the Rinalda House Museum of American Art kicks off Cinema Under the Stars, Heroes and Legends, outdoor film series with the 1938 Errol Flynn movie, The Adventures of Robin Hood. This Oscar-winning classic, along with countless other adventure films that came after it, was greatly influenced by 19th century book illustrator Howard Pyle. Hollywood directors, costume designers, screenwriters, and more have continually drawn on Pyle's colorful recreations of the past, and movie pirates of the golden era of cinema to Johnny Depp have all worn costumes inspired by Pyle's illustrations. The great Vincent van Gogh himself once wrote that Pyle's work struck him dumb with admiration, and at 8 o'clock tonight, you'll find out why during Rinalda's pre-screening talk. It's titled Buried Treasure, Howard Pyle and the Silver Screen, and it'll be given by my guest today, art historian and Wake Forest University professor David Lubin. He's well acquainted with Pyle. Last year, on the 100th anniversary of the artist's death, David was invited to speak at the Delaware Art Museum in Wilmington, Pyle's hometown, where the largest collection of Pyle's work resides. David's just returned from another talk on Pyle's work and influence at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Massachusetts. And yes, turns out Norman Rockwell himself was a Pyle devotee as well.
So I had always heard about Pyle since I was a child. I had loved movies that were inspired by Howard Pyle, comic books, books. I was very aware of his name. And the Delaware Art Museum asked me if I would write an essay for the catalog on Pyle's influence on pirate movies. I was busy. I had other things I needed to do, but that was just too great a topic. I couldn't let it go since I remembered all those nights I used to stay up as a kid watching these Errol Flynn pirate movies. So I took the assignment and I started doing an investigation of Pyle's, specifically his art about piracy. Now, I should say that Howard Pyle was the most influential book illustrator of late 19th, early 20th century America. In fact, he's considered the father of American book illustration.
What telltale aspects jump out at you?
Well, I'd say there are four aspects that jump out of Howard Pyle. First, his line drawings of Robin Hood. He was the one who basically created our image of Robin Hood through these beautiful line drawings he did for an 1883 edition of Robin Hood. Secondly, he did pictures of King Arthur and his knights. And the more you look, the more you see the sort of depths within depths of these fabulous drawings. Then he also did great black and white and color illustrations of pirates. He was fascinated by piracy. This is in the 1890s, early 1900s. He was a Quaker. He said, "Isn't it odd that a Quaker gentleman from Pennsylvania would be so taken with acts of violence and brigandry?" And the final thing that Pyle is remembered for is his children's books illustrations, the fairy tale illustrations he did. And many of his students went on to become famous illustrators of fairy tales.
Okay. So you were enthralled with the prospect of getting to research this further and really talk about Pyle at these in two venues, as it turns out, one beginning in Delaware and then later in Massachusetts. As you're researching this, what were some of the things that kind of set you going? And when did you start making these connections with the past and present?
Well, at first, the essay I was writing for the catalog was very limited on the subjects of Pyle and pirate imagery. And so I was doing a lot of research into how Hollywood in the 1920s, during the silent period, how they were looking back to Pyle. And in fact, the first really famous pirate movie is called The Black Pirate, made by Douglas Fairbanks. And I found out that Douglas Fairbanks, somebody had given him a copy of Pyle's pirate stories. And he was so enthralled by that. Here, he's an adult, but he just said, "I've got to make a movie of that." And as people will see who go to my Renault House lecture, I show scenes from that original film, and it's so clear that Douglas Fairbanks, who directed the film under a pseudonym, he was directly looking at Pyle. So I wrote the article on Pyle and piracy, and then when the 100th anniversary of his death was coming up and the Delaware Art Museum was putting together this major retrospective of his art, they contacted me. They said, "Well, we liked your article for the catalog. Would you consider coming to Wilmington and giving a public lecture on Pyle and piracy?" And I said, "Well, sure, I'll do that. But I want to expand it beyond piracy to also talk about Robin Hood and King Arthur," because I realized the more research I did, the more aware I was of how so many facets of Hollywood had been influenced by Pyle. In fact, it's kind of comic that Hollywood has been pirating Pyle's pirate images back from the 1920s. His estate never got anything for all the images that were ripped off and used by Hollywood filmmakers.
How accurate were Pyle's perceptions of pirate garb and even King Arthur's garb and appearances of the day?
Well, Pyle, he became an art teacher. He wanted to give back to his profession. And so he started an art school in Wilmington, Delaware. And some of the most famous illustrators of the early 20th century passed through the doors of that school and trained with Pyle. And he was insistent that when you do an illustration from the past, you have to do all kinds of historical research. You have to go to the library, go to old magazines, read descriptions. He would have his art students sew together costumes based on descriptions in books. And not only that, he would say to illustrators, to his students, if you are depicting some emotion in one of your illustrations, you have to feel that emotion. You have to get into the minds and the hearts and the sort of passions of the character that you're depicting. It's never any good just to imagine, oh, this is what this character would have looked like. You have to really feel the feelings that animate that character. The show left Delaware. It then went to and is still at the Norman Rockwell Museum in Stockbridge, Massachusetts. They have an artist-in-residence program, and so I went to the class of an illustrator who's very successful, does a lot of like record covers and magazine work. And it was just really great to hear him say what an incredible influence Howard Pyle has been on him here in the 21st century. So the man's sort of legend lives on, certainly in the world of illustration.
And we've mentioned Rockwell three times. Should point out that he fell under the spell of Pyle.
He very much, as a young man, you know, was so inspired by Pyle. Now, the one difference maybe is that Norman Rockwell had much more of a sense of humor than Howard Pyle. Rockwell was much more about doing illustrations of the present day, wanted to find a narrative narrative angle of human interest in any everyday scene, where Pyle was often, because he was an illustrator, was often taking more dramatic moments from a story. But they still had that desire to find the human life, the sort of the raw inner life of a scene. Curators of the Delaware Art Museum said, well, you're completely right about Pirates of the Caribbean. The filmmakers actually spent a lot of time going through our archives looking at Pyle's images and illustrations. The way Johnny Depp is made up to look is straight out of Pyle.
How about that? How many parallels are there within the industry, the film industry only, of someone who was that influential 150 years ago today? Are there any?
Well, not that many that I can think of. But, I mean, Pyle just gave way so easily to Hollywood because he was looking at the past in a sort of dramatic, romantic, but authentic. I would say authentic in quotes. Again, he's imagining what the past looked like, but in a way that felt very realistic. And so he was a natural for Hollywood. But as I've talked to filmmakers, and when I've had an opportunity to meet camera cinematographers and set designers, it's always interesting to me how often, if they're making a movie, particularly a movie set in the past, how often they're going to the art books and looking at the art that painters and draftsmen were presenting of that period.
Hmm. We talked about Rockwell earlier, and looking back, it seems like there was only one, what I would call a political-leaning drawing of his. One that stands out was the first African-American student being escorted to school with the National Guard there.
Yeah, I just saw that up in the Norman Rockwell.
Were there any parallels there in terms of Pyle's work? Did he have any political statements through his work?
Well, not as direct as that. But I noticed that at the beginning of his career, when he was a young, starving artist just making his way, he was fascinated by Robin Hood. He said that as a kid, his mother had read Robin Hood legends to him. And Pyle, this is a little sidestep, but Pyle's edition of Robin Hood, which was published in 1883, is the first modern compilation of all the Robin Hood stories. These things had been around since the 1400s in various oral traditions and various poems and legends and ballads. But Pyle gathers them together and makes them into basically a novel, and then he illustrates that novel, and that made him famous. Well, one of the things that I concluded, this isn't in the biographies of Pyle, but it's something that struck me, is around 1900, when he was very rich and successful, he's still a good man, but he sort of lost interest in Robin Hood and became interested in King Arthur instead. And this is purely speculation, but I think that once Pyle became very famous and started hanging out with presidents and Congress people, then a person who robs from the rich to give to the poor was no longer maybe the ideal model for him. And instead, it seems that what he became interested in is modeling the ideal head of state. And that's why I think King Arthur became such an interest to him. At the same time, I was noticing this was in the late 1890s, and he's doing a lot of paintings. This is really when the pirate stuff begins. He starts doing paintings of pirates on the Spanish Main, people stealing treasure from one another and sort of brutal thuggery. And this is at the time when in American society we're having a war with Spain to take Cuba away from Spain and also the Philippines. And I think that notion of American imperialism is just getting started during that period. And I think Pyle's illustrations, either directly or indirectly, are talking about, is it right, is it morally right to steal gold from another land, to colonize another island? He has so many images which talk about or dramatize that kind of taking of treasure from someone else.
My thanks to art historian and Wake Forest University professor David Lubin. Tonight at 8 o'clock at Rinalda House, David will give the pre-screening talk titled Buried Treasure, Howard Pyle and the Silver Screen. Then the Rinalda House Museum of American Art kicks off its Cinema Under the Stars, Heroes and Legends outdoor film series with the 1938 Errol Flynn classic, The Adventures of Robin Hood. You'll find more information about this year's Heroes and Legends film series and links to Pyle's swashbuckling images on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts.
You're listening to Triad Arts Up Close. I'm David Ford. Zone of Contention, the U.S.-Mexico border, is a powerful exhibition going on right now at the Weatherspoon Art Museum in Greensboro. It focuses on artists' investigations of issues related to the U.S.-Mexico border through photography, sculpture, works on paper, video, and new media. Subjects such as migrant labor, the DREAM Act, and border control are being examined in terms of their current social impact. Zone of Contention, the U.S.-Mexico border, runs through September 2nd and features new and recent works by artists from Mexico, Canada, and the U.S., including my guest today, Greensboro's Todd Drake. Todd's new exhibit, Help, Hidden Work, Hidden Lives, draws a line from the enslaved to the undocumented, exposing a repeating history of exploitation. It's one man's call to help those struggling for a better life through work and education. You'll find a link to Todd's new Vimeo production of Help on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. 3 years ago, I spoke with Todd about another project involving social justice titled Muslim Self-Portraits. His traveling exhibit, which was years in the making, combined photo images and written narratives of Muslim Americans living in North Carolina. The project began in the Triad, but over the last 3 years, Todd and Muslim Self-Portraits have literally traveled the world to Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Europe, among other locations, generating passionate discussions about Muslim assimilation in America along the way. I mean, the international nature of this scope is kind of a new direction for you in broad strokes as the modern artist today. Talk about the need for that sort of movement today, given what we're surrounded with, the economy, whatever factors involved.
When the hunting gets scarce locally, you have to go farther afield. And getting out your back door and crossing borders, going to new territory is really necessary. I've been amazed at the reception of my work in the Middle East, in Europe.
I see Berlin on the list of many stops here.
Yeah, I spent 10 days in Berlin looking at both the experience of Muslims living in Europe and also trying to get a tap on what the art scene is like in Berlin. And what I discovered is really those two stories are overlapping. Berlin has gone through a redevelopment period after the reunification, and the poorer areas of the community where migrants have settled have also become the focal points for artists. There's still quite a bit of racism that is being suffered by people, particularly from African and Turkish backgrounds.
Mm.
It's maybe a take-home message for artists is to use your network of friendships, not in an exploitative way, but just in a sharing way. And for example, my opportunity to go to Bahrain was a result of me telling a colleague of mine where I taught about my project. She then told a friend who happened to be married to someone in the United Nations. And then that resulted in an invitation to go to Bahrain. So I think those types of connections are really important, and they go way beyond the borders of North Carolina.
Something good has begun. Oh, peace, stay in sound and loud. Died on the peace train.
You just coincidentally used the word borders in our conversation, mm-hmm. Which leads me to talk about hidden work, hidden lives, and the work continuing to be exhibited at Weatherspoon. When we initially spoke 3 years ago, you had done some work on this topic, obviously the immigrant worker, a subject that's near and dear to your heart.
That work came back in my mind because of the struggle I was seeing the DREAM Act student going under. I was looking for a new way to really share the story of the undocumented immigrant and also their children, some of which are the DREAM Act eligible students that were brought here as children, went through our school system, but now are being blocked from being able to, you know, attend college or to gain their citizenship. I really wanted a vehicle that would put that in front of people, but also link it to a broader perspective on history, because through my studies and living in the American South, I really saw that there is an ongoing tradition here and everywhere, actually, of taking advantage of marginalized workers. And so if we look at Jim Crow era and the fact that African Americans were really blocked and kept within narrow occupational opportunities, if we look at chain gang experience in the American South, where African American men were arrested oftentimes without good cause and then put into chain gangs to create labor for corporations. If we look at slavery, these are examples of taking advantage of communities of workers. And I wanted to link the current practice with that. So that was one reason. The other reason was to provoke everyone today to think about how are we going to write this final chapter. And Obama has recently, you know, made a decision to give an opportunity for DREAM Act eligible students to stay and to work. And I think that's going to play out maybe not as a total win for that community. I think there's going to be still some problems. One example of that is these DREAM Act students might have an opportunity to gain a work visa, but their parents, whom they're still very dependent upon, are undocumented. So their opportunities for success are very questionable still.
The images that I'm seeing there, as always, with your great work, really capture moments and say so much. And then the narrative coupled with that, did you get input, as you did with Muslim Self-Portraits, from the individuals you're focusing on with Hidden Work, Hidden Lives?
Yeah, the narratives are coming from the participants. So I'm, again, trying to use both their story and a strong image to stop the viewer. Just came back from a show in Wyoming at a Japanese internment camp museum. Worked with a student who said that his father's strong work ethic was, you know, a story that was still guiding him as an adult.
I was once like you are now, and I know that it's not easy to be calm when you found something going on.
Well, you're a great storyteller. I want you to share one that particularly moved you while going through this training. How long was this in the making?
This process has been a year project, and it will probably take another 2 or 3 years to flesh out. I'm really still interested in gathering more narratives from the African-American community, the experience of Jim Crow, for example. Some of the narratives that moved me most deeply with this project included several given to me by Sonia Parker, a good friend of mine, who grew up as an African-American in rural North Carolina. She told me a story about how when she was a young child, this is in probably the 60s, she would go to downtown stores to go shopping with her mother, but they weren't allowed to use the restrooms because they were African-American. And so she would have to go to the bathroom in the alley. And she can remember as a small child being scolded by whites because she had been forced to do that in the alley. And so we tell her story and we include a pair of shoes, children's shoes, in the exhibition to have as a visual connection to that. And though that may be not directly related to work, it is directly related to this idea of commerce and being somewhat invited into the process but also excluded. She later moved to Brooklyn and had a very different experience growing up. Another powerful story comes from Giovanna. She is a undocumented student who struggled with trying to find a way to further her education after high school. She tells her story through video, and this is something I'm starting to add to my exhibitions. And her touching story revolves around realizing that, in fact, she was different from her peers, that she couldn't go on to law school. She later became married and was abused during that marriage, taken advantage of because of her status. She had both a protecting kind of relationship with the police. She asked for their protection, but then they also turned on her because of her status. And so this is a very complex, compelling story, and it makes for one of the most moving moments in the show. It's such a waste of potential and also a waste of an investment. You know, we've educated her K through 12. And we've, as a society, said that's, you know, that's important to do. We shouldn't turn away a child from an education. Yet when she graduates, then she's not able really to go on to pursue her college dream. And I know a lot of American citizens are struggling, you know, with that. And we have a lot of wasted potential just because of tuition. But we've really set very conscious roadblocks in front of this community. It's still a question that's open.
For the person who says, you know, we were born and raised here, we're legal, and our son is struggling to get into a college, we're struggling to be able to afford that. Why should this individual get a scholarship, say, this young woman whose parents are not, who are here illegally? Why should they be competing with our son to get that coveted spot in our local college, say?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the dreamer would answer that question just basically with, I'm a part of this community too. You know, I've been here sometimes my whole life. My family has paid taxes. It's a myth that undocumented immigrants don't pay their taxes. In fact, they pay taxes and Social Security, which they'll never receive. We could take the billions of dollars paid into the Social Security system by undocumented and give a portion of that to scholarships, and no one would, I think, complain. That's money that we've taken that will never be given back to the person who contributed it. So it's a complex moral situation. How I try to cut through that as an artist is I try to go back to the beginning point, which is we've got to consider everyone in our presence as being fully human. If we start to dehumanize the other, the person that's around us that's not really like us, then the opportunity for abuse really arises.
My thanks to artist and educator Todd Drake. His new exhibit, Help, Hidden Work, Hidden Lives, focuses on undocumented laborers in America. It's part of the Weatherspoon Art Museum's show, Zone of Contention, the U.S.-Mexico border, curated by Zandra Eden. Zone of Contention is up through September 2nd at the Weatherspoon in Greensboro, and you'll find links to more information and Todd's brand new Vimeo production of Help, Hidden Work, Hidden Lives on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's program. Our senior producer is Catherine Mobley, and our audio engineer is Eddie Garcia. You'll find links to more information about all of the arts organizations and events we've covered today on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. Please send your questions, comments, and suggestions to triadarts@wfu.edu. I'm David Ford. Thanks for joining me today for Triad Arts Up Close.